the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. New York Times journalist Dave Itzkoff is my guest. He's the author of several books, and his newest is the story of the making of one of the great films of the 1970s, Hollywood's second golden age. The book is Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in the Movies. Dave Itzkoff, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
You know, there are a few writers who rose to fame during that early years of live television, and they became like name above the title celebrities. Reginald Rose was one, and Rod Serling, and the subject of your book, Paddy Chayefsky. And each of those guys had like one killer teleplay that put them in the public eye, and they became the writers that the public knew and watched for their latest work. I don't think there's any writer of television or movies that's like that now. You know, maybe Aaron Sorkin, but I don't think he's anywhere near the household name that Paddy Chayefsky was.
I mean, it's hard to gauge. I think you're right, though, that Sorkin is definitely maybe the closest analog to the people that you mentioned. But of course, you know, television was a brand new medium in that era. It wasn't even clear yet, what TV was going to be, or you know, what form it would take, or who would be the important people in it. What is it going to be, you know, an actor-driven medium, or the fact that writers like Chayefsky, you know, very quickly became synonymous with the form. They really sort of helped shape its destiny.
And at the time, and of course even still today, television was criticized, especially then, as being, you know, the vast wasteland, and that famous quote, and the Beverly Hillbillies, or that's a little bit later, but you know what I mean. That there, although I happen to like the Beverly Hillbillies, but you know what, there was a lot of.
I know they get a bad rap.
They
do, don't they?
but there was a lot of crap on TV, and there still is. But you know, those guys, Paddy Chayefsky, and Rod Serling, and others like them, they were really striving for quality. I think if you even tried to do those exact same works today, I don't think people would respond to them, because I just don't think people understand or have the patience for really good drama that has a lot of talking in it.
Well, I think that, you know, it's funny that, you know, I think there is a sort of a reemerging tradition of that now in TV, but it's certainly not on the broadcast networks. I mean, all of that has, to the extent that it exists, it's all kind of fled to cable TV. And I think, you know, the cable TV writers, whether it's, you know, Matt Weiner on Mad Men, or Vince Gilligan, who created Breaking Bad, I mean, in some ways they are coming right out of that tradition of, you know, Paddy Chayefsky and, you know, the anthology dramas of the 1950s, where you had these kind of, you know, basically, you know, rotating ensembles every week, and, you know, all of that was, you know, that was all steered towards Sunday night. That was sort of the one night of the week when people would kind of huddle around for more highbrow TV fare, and the expectation was, you know, that was when you had sort of the largest audience to capitalize on, and you wanted that sort of Monday morning water cooler effect of people talking about it at work the next day. And it's ebbed and flowed, but I think, you know, that that whole phenomenon has survived for, you know, more than 60 years.
There's a huge difference in those writers that you mentioned, and of course I love Mad Men and I loved Breaking Bad, but I also loved, in the golden age of television, the fact that they were able to tell a wonderful story in one episode. You know, you could watch a Dr. Kildare, and it would be very well written, or a Twilight Zone, or Gunsmoke. It'd be very well written, and it would be over in 28 minutes or 52 minutes. And you didn't need to watch every single episode to be able to follow the story.
Well, I think certainly, you know, in that era, what's changed is that, you know, I think all the networks, cable and broadcast, they basically kind of lost their spines. That they're so sort of fearful about people fleeing to, you know, whether it's another channel or just some other medium of entertainment altogether, that they just don't want to risk, you know, you're ever, you know, tuning away. And their solution to that right now seems to be that, you know, everything has to be, you know, serialized and you know, you know, the era of, you know, a kind of standalone story, you know, I think that takes a certain amount of confidence that the broadcasters have kind of lost.
You know, now that thinking about it as you're saying it, even comic books, when I was a kid, I used to love, I still read a lot of comics, but I used to really love, you know, like you could pick up a Superman or Spider-Man even, and although with Spider-Man there was a certain continuity, you didn't have to read every single issue to be able to follow it, whereas now in comics, you know, there's no jumping on point, you have to know so much.
Yeah, well, I think there's, you know, I mean, there is a sort of larger, you know, crisis of narrative that's happening right now, I mean, across entertainment, and certainly, you know, as, you know, choices are kind of, you know, multiplying, and people have, you know, not only, it's not only TV competing with movies, competing with printed matter, but, of course, everything that we know that's happening on the Internet, and you know, I mean, everything is competing with everything else. There's just a tremendous fear of, you know, we can't risk losing anybody's attention span even momentarily. And I mean, you can talk about, you know, what's happening in all the storytelling mediums that you talked about. You can talk about how you know, Hollywood is essentially, you know, rebooting its properties every 2 minutes, and that, you know, it will, on the one hand, it will only use existing franchises, and then it keeps starting them over every 3 movies. There's a multiplicity of problems that you know, I think all sort of stem from this idea that we're talking about.
Yeah, and it's interesting because when we got to Network, and I remember when Network came out very well, you know, I didn't realize then, and I doubt that anybody did, that that was the culmination of the work of Paddy Chayefsky. I think people thought, well, you know, here comes the next thing, and it was the greatest thing he'd ever done, but I think, oh, you know, what will be next? And there really never was another. That was really the greatest work he ever produced.
Oh, I would agree. I mean, it's very sad in a sense that, you know, that he died, you know, only 5 years after the film came out. The only movie he was able to make after was Altered States, which he was extremely disappointed with and didn't put his name on. But it's also true, as you say, that, you know, I think even to the public that kind of knew him and followed his career to some extent, people were kind of mystified by Network, in the sense that those in the audience who kind of knew his TV work and knew things like Marty, which were these very, you know, sweet and sensitive dramas, they couldn't quite understand how did the person who made that also become the person who made Network, which is very, you know, angry and, a real polemic. And, you know, the people asked him, you know, where's the sensitivity? Where did it go? And to his mind, I mean, all of his stories were, you know, sensitive dramas. But certainly, you know, something had changed and something had evolved in the 20-odd years in between.
Well, the film that precedes Network, The Hospital, I can't remember if it's The.
The Hospital,
that was with George C. Scott and Diana Rigg, and it kind of gave, you know, it was sort of the Hospital version of Network, but maybe not nearly as cynical. Pretty cynical, though.
No, I think, you know, in the years, you know, certainly in the, you know, as, you know, when Network was really becoming a phenomenon, I think Chayefsky would acknowledge that The Hospital was kind of a dry run for Network, even though, you know, very different setting and different themes. I mean, the larger idea about, you know, the films being as much about, you know, these characters and individuals as being about an institution that stood in as a kind of microcosm for all of society, and by showing, you know, basically all the different dysfunctions in how it operated, it was sort of showing you how, you know, people just are totally frustrated in pursuing their desires, that there's always somebody else standing in their way, or, you know, somebody who, basically everybody is motivated by, you know, what's easiest and most desirable for themselves. It ends up canceling out what somebody else is after, and so therefore we all end up frustrated in some way.
We're talking with Dave Itzkoff, and he's written this book called Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in the Movies, Paddy Chayefsky. So Network, I mean, it was a great film, and I hope that everybody listening have seen the movie because I want to talk about the movie. And it was a phenomenally successful movie. I mean, at the time, I remember people wearing buttons that said, "Mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore." And there were bumper stickers, and it was just, that phrase really caught on, and that scene in the movie was a phenomenally successful thing.
Yeah, and the moment itself, I mean, it's become indelible. I think almost, you know, the sequence of, you know, Howard Beale essentially losing his mind on the air and, you know, commanding his audience to go to their windows and shout it out. It's fascinating that, I think, you know, certainly as Chayefsky, you know, composed that particular sequence, I think he felt very invested in it, but I don't think he had any sense that that particular part of the film would basically come to stand in for the whole movie, and that that line was going to become the sort of catchphrase that it became. And even in the years, you know, after the movie was released, even in the sort of flush of its release and its success, you know, and the studio would send him, you know, press clippings showing him all the different ways that the phrase "mad as hell" was manifesting itself in the culture. And I think at a certain point, I think that began to frustrate him, that in some ways, you know, that it was reductive, or, you know, it was oversimplifying the various themes in the movie. And he felt that, you know, audiences weren't totally understanding or grasping everything that he was trying to do with the movie. It was almost too easy just to kind of boil it down to those three words, which of course we took as the title of the book.
I'm sure he would be pissed off at you for that. But
probably.
And I think actually he would be very pleased that you wrote such a great book. I watched, after I read your book, I watched Network again, and I enjoyed watching it again, but I do think that the movie, I'm not saying that it doesn't hold up, and because it's a great movie and it's got fabulous actors, William Holden, Faye Dunaway, Peter Finch, Beatrice Straight, her scene is just great, and Robert Duvall and Ned Beatty. And it's directed by Sidney Lumet. But the prescient nature of it, of all the outrageous things that were going to happen, is kind of lost on audiences today, since absolutely every one of those things has actually occurred.
I don't want to, you know, I think everybody's experience is different, and it's certainly, if that's the experience you had, I won't tell you it's not possible. But yeah, one of the pleasures of you know, promoting a book like this is, you know, we've done some screenings of the film with various audiences, and, you know, then discussions afterwards, and I find that it, in some, you know, I feel like it does hold up, and in fact, you know, for audiences, especially, you know, I mean, there's the audience who, you know, saw it, you know, in its release, and, you know, maybe remembered enjoying it or has only a vague sense of the film since that era, and they get to sort of reimmerse themselves in it. But I think for people who, you know, basically came of age after the movie was released, who grew up maybe in the 80s and 90s and more recently, who really don't remember a time when the media was any different than it is now, I think that they appreciate it all the same, that there's this sense that, I mean, there's almost a kind of a gallows humor to it, that you're basically watching a movie and this person sort of warning you, well, this is what's going to happen if we're not careful, if we don't pay attention to what we're doing, and if we aren't, you know, if we aren't sort of more noble in our ambitions. And now, you know, you watch that movie knowing that all these things came true, you sort of realize, oh, okay, you know, we didn't heed the warning, and we weren't any better people than the movie made us out to be. And I mean, it's a little bit depressing, but there is a kind of humor in it. It's not like slipping on a banana peel humor, but there's, you know, the only, what else can you do but laugh?
Well, it's a very, very funny movie. I mean, there's some terrifically funny lines and funny scenes and funny situations. Although I think the movie is a comedy, a satirical comedy, even though
Absolutely.
It's very, very dramatic. And that reminds me of Beatrice Straight's scene. Beatrice Straight, I don't think any other actress, maybe Judi Dench, who won for one tiny little scene once, winning an Oscar for, I think she's on screen for about 10 minutes.
Yeah, if that much. I mean, certainly, the sequence that everyone remembers, where, you know, she's you know, confronting William Holden about his affair with Faye Dunaway's character. I mean, that whole sequence is just about 5 minutes, and that's really, you know, the segment of the movie that she won the Oscar for. And I mean, if you go back, I mean, that year she was nominated up against some real heavyweights. I mean, you know, Piper Laurie from Carrie, which is also, you know what I mean, just a classic performance. And so the fact that she won, I mean, it really tells you just how searing that one scene was, and certainly that has a tremendous amount to do with her performance, and also, you know, to do with Chayefsky's writing of that scene.
It's very well written scene. It really has that feeling of, you know, of Marty or of some of the other works that he did in that live TV era of. It's just a beautifully written scene.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not often that, you know, the sort of, to hear the wronged woman or the wronged spouse, you know, really get to put her feelings on the line in that way. I mean, that's what drama is all about, that people who generally don't get to express themselves, you know, doing it with sort of, you know, kind of maximum articulateness.
And it is a Patty Chayefsky film. That's, you know, kind of, it just amazes me that it's not a Sidney Lumet film. I can't think of a, you know, there's no other movie now that would have that. There's no.
Well, he certainly demanded it and fought for it, and to some extent, it, you know, that limited. I mean, part of the reason why, you know, his output is not as you know, as deep or as prolific as it could have been, is because, you know, he was essentially averse to and really walked away from, you know, projects where he couldn't get total control over the material. That was sort of, you know, his lifelong quest, essentially, in his career. It was to always have control over, you know, what he was doing, whatever his name appeared on. Even if you go back to, I think, the very first book of his that's published is a collection of his teleplays, and he wrote a short introduction for that, and you know, it's an essay, you know, sort of about, you know, how he likes TV and he's hopeful for it, but then most of it is him complaining about, again, how little control over his work he has and what happens to it once he submits a script and then anybody else can rewrite it. It can be cast without any, you know, input from him. So, you know, right away, he's sort of identifying in his career all the things that bother him and all the things he's going to basically spend the rest of his life pushing back against.
How did someone like Sidney Lumet feel about a writer who demanded so much power?
You know, I think it really speaks to Lumet's spirit of collaboration that he was willing to sign on for a project like this. He, of course, came in with his own credentials from the golden age of television, and not only at that point a reputation as, you know, a superb director of live television, but also a highly accomplished filmmaker by that point, and had already released movies like Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon that had come out in the 70s. He was also just, you know, fabulously productive and would turn out maybe two or even three movies in a year, and was known for working very speedily and really just coming to a shoot with basically all the shots already worked out and doing things in as few takes as possible. But it was certainly a concession to come in, you know, a knowing concession that he made, that if he was going to do this film with Chayefsky, he was not going to be in charge in the way that a director normally is, that he was going to be, if not, you know, a collaborator, even sort of, you know, subordinate to Chayefsky, which is not to say that Lumet did not get to exercise a lot of his own sensibility. And you can really see his dynamism in the movie, particularly all the sequences that are set in the TV studio, whether it's the sort of early, you know, news broadcast in the film, or at the very end when the Beale Show just becomes this kind of crazy Savonarola-style talk show. That, you know, that's all Lumet. And I think that, you know, the parts of the movie that are a little stagier and that are just basically people either, you know, talking at each other or shouting at each other, that's really more Chayefsky. That's his, you know, him coming from the background more of the stage and live television, which was much more static.
Lots of talking. There's a lot of talking.
Oh, yes.
but it's great talking. We're talking with Dave Itzkoff, and he's written this book called Mad as Hell about the making of Network. Now, what is it? Why didn't you just write the story of Paddy Chayefsky? What made you want to use Network as the centerpiece of your book?
Well, I mean, there were a few reasons. I was certainly, you know, I will say I had the opportunity going back about 3 years ago. All of Paddy Chayefsky's papers are owned now by the New York Public Library, and anyone is free to access them. And they had invited me just to take a look at some of the papers that related specifically to Network, just to see if I thought there might be, you know, like an article for the Times in it, which there certainly was, and just, you know, to leaf through, you know, some of the screenplay draft and some of the correspondence that Chayefsky kept throughout the making of the film in the years preceding, the years following. That was just a, you know, truly a delight to get to dive into that and just to see how, you know, vibrant a writer he was in all the writing that he did, and how very alive he still is in all those documents. And certainly, you know, after having written that article, we talked a little bit about, you know, could there be a sort of, you know, full-on biography of Chayefsky. But as we sort of shaped the idea, I mean, we realized that in telling the story of Network, I mean, you have to tell the story of Chayefsky. You have to explain, you know, who he was and how his career evolved to get him to that place. But this movie really is his magnum opus, and there are so many great tales that you get to unpack in focusing on that particular film. And then you also get the opportunity to tell, you know, not only what happened to all the players in the movie and how prophetic the movie was for, you know, basically the way their lives were going to play out, but then also the tale of, you know, really what happened to our media in the years that followed and how accurately the movie really did predict what was going to transpire. So that, in focusing the book that way, it lets you tell those other tales.
It's also interesting the issues around the movie after its release. Well, you delve into how the movie was shown on television, how people objected. I mean, Faye Dunaway had a problem with a British showing of the film.
Well, that stems from what she was objecting to in that particular case was in the essentially the love scene that she performs with William Holden. That not only did she object to how it was being broadcast in Britain, where she believed that, you know, her nipples were visible, but if you go all the way back to the production of the movie, she really tried to get that whole scene excised from the movie, or at the very least, she just did not want to film it that way. Did not want to have a love scene. And I mean, if people remember that sequence, it's not that it's a particularly, you know, titillating scene. It's not, you know, I guess you could argue whether it is or is not exploitive of her. But the joke of the scene is that the whole time that she and Holden are, you know, getting it on, and even in the aftermath, she's just talking the whole time and constantly talking about her ratings and the TV shows that she wants to develop and what the rival networks are doing.
Right.
And so, I mean, the scene is very much a joke on the character of Diana Christensen and how, you know, singularly driven she is by her own career. So it certainly did to Chayefsky and to his colleagues. It was very important that the scene be included, and, of course, to Chayefsky that it be shot exactly as it was written. And Dunaway was just in a very different place in her career, I think. Certainly, you know, she had done either, you know, suggestive scenes or nude scenes in Bonnie and Clyde and in Chinatown. But, you know, before she made Network, she had just gotten married to the rock musician Peter Wolfe. I think, you know, she was trying to move her life in a different direction. She was trying, I think, to have a little more control over her own life and her body, and just maybe didn't want to be depicted in that way. And there was a huge standoff over that one particular scene that had to basically be codified in this kind of informal contract, almost like a treaty of war, a treaty of peace after a war between her and the film's producer, Howard Gottfried, that really spells out in this very clinical way, you know, exactly how the film, how that scene was going to be filmed and what Dunaway would or would not have to do in it. And even after shooting it, she still felt that the, you know, basically the language of that treaty had been violated, because she felt that, you know, you could see, you know, parts of her body that she didn't want to display.
It's funny, too, because the scene, even though she's the one doing all the talking, it's not about her. It's really, the scene is about William Holden's character and, you know, the midlife crisis that he's going through.
I think that he also had his own uneasiness. I mean, he was just never a great fan of love scenes at all, for as many as he did in his career. And he sort of allows himself, if you look back at some of the publicity and interviews that he and Dunaway did around the release of Network, I mean, he really lets himself kind of be the fall guy. And he, you know, when he would joke about how awkward the scene was for him, but never really letting on that, you know, the tremendous and strenuous objections that Faye Dunaway had.
It's a classic scene. Well, we were saying that it's the culmination of the work of Paddy Chayefsky, but as it turned out, it was also the culminating work of the three major stars in the movie. One, Peter Finch, because he died shortly afterwards, but William Holden and Faye Dunaway really never made great pictures of that level again.
No. I mean, sadly, you know, William Holden also died just a few years after the film was released, and, you know, and he was nominated for an Oscar for Network, but, you know, never really would sort of, you know, hit that same kind of height again. And Dunaway, even though she continued to work for, you know, for years and decades afterwards, and won the Oscar for Network, you know, in that case, it was a very, very sort of sharply declining trajectory, you know, after the film came out, that in a sense, you know, winning the Oscar gave her, you know, kind of maximum, you know, influence and power over her own career in terms of being able to choose really whatever project she wanted to do next, and she could get paid, you know, quite a bit for those next roles. And so the roles that she ended up choosing, I mean, it all, in within about 5 years, leads her to make Mommy Dearest, which is just, you know, savaged critically and, you know, performs very badly at the box office. And, you know, even though, of course, she continues to work and work for many years after, I mean, that movie is really sort of looked at as, you know, really sort of, you know, ending the career that you know, Network, you know, might have otherwise led to.
Mommy Dearest, the film that destroyed the reputation of two actresses.
Right.
Faye Dunaway and Joan Crawford.
And Joan Crawford, right.
This book is called Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in the Movies. And the author is Dave Itzkoff. Thanks so much for talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time, and you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, please check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Dave Itzkoff. His book, Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in the Movies. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.